Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, working with gypsy communities throughout the world, a two-day conference opens here in the Vatican. The right to be free from poverty and hunger, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights says crucial development goals must go hand in hand with efforts to promote peace and security. But first, Pope Benedict appeals for an end to the growing political crisis in Lebanon. Welcome to the programme. Concerned about the growing political crisis in Beirut, Pope Benedict on Sunday appealed for dialogue and a negotiated solution to the sectarian tensions that threaten peace and stability in Lebanon and throughout the volatile Middle Eastern region. Speaking at his midday Angelus address, the Pope urged the Lebanese politicians and people to persevere with patience and keep the good of the country at the heart of their actions. Earlier in the day, the Pope was greeted by enthusiastic young families as he visited a new church in one of Rome's southern suburbs. My colleague Emma McCarthy tells us more about Pope Benedict's Sunday activities.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, seguo con viva preoccupazione quanto sta accadendo in Medio Oriente.
Following his traditional Sunday blessing, Pope Benedict XVI told the thousands gathered beneath his study window that he is greatly worried by what is happening in the Middle East. He noted that glimmers of a solution to the crises that plague the region are contrasted by tensions and difficulties that make many fear new violence.
Una speciale menzione merita il Libano.
Lebanon, he said, merits a special mention. The country has been racked recently by demonstrations that threaten to divide the nation along sectarian lines, with most Sunni Muslims supporting the Sunni Prime Minister and Shiites backing Hezbollah, while the Christian community finds itself split along the middle. In his Angelus address, the Pope recalled Lebanon's role as an example of tolerance and peaceful cohabitation in the region. He said that today, like yesterday, people of different cultures and religions are called to live there, to build a nation of dialogue for the common good.
Chiedo ai libanesi e ai loro responsabili politici di avere a cuore esclusivamente il bene del paese.
The Holy Father appealed directly to the country's political leaders to have the best for their community and country at heart and to work exclusively for harmony between its communities. He urged them to inspire the Lebanese people to communal unity, pointing out that it is everyone's responsibility and that it asks patience and perseverance of all those involved. He also urged the international community to commit to seeking a trusting dialogue and urgent solutions to the crises.
In questo grave momento. On the second Sunday of Advent, the Church puts before us the figure of John the Baptist, the voice crying in the wilderness, "Prepare way for the Lord."
Earlier in his Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict XVI continued his reflections on Advent.
During this Advent season, as we wait in joyful hope for the coming of Christ, let us prepare a place for him in our hearts.
But the Holy Father began this second Sunday of Advent and of the new liturgical year among the faithful of his diocese when he travelled to the south of Rome early Sunday morning to dedicate a newly erected church.
Buongiorno, cari fratelli e sorelle. Sono contento di...
Families from Mary Star of Evangelization Parish turned out in their thousands to welcome their bishop, Pope Benedict, who thanked them for withstanding the cold winter temperatures and inclement skies. In his homily, the Holy Father compared the parish to a beacon, which in today's secularized society irradiates the light of faith, an answering call to man's deepest desires. giving hope and meaning to people's lives.
La Chiesa esiste perché in essa incontriamo Cristo, il Figlio del Dio vivente.
The Church, said the Pope, is a home which unites us with God. As a man and a woman through their love become one body, so Christ and humanity gathered in the Church through God's love become one spirit. God's love and his joy, concluded the Pope, is our strength.
È questa la gioia che Dio ci dà.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's Sunday activities. English Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor has announced that he and three other Christian leaders are preparing for a pilgrimage to the Holy Land in the week leading up to Christmas. Joining the head of the Catholic Bishops' Conference on this trip are the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, the Primate of the Armenian Church of Great Britain, Bishop Nathan Hov Hanissian, and the Free Church's moderator, Reverend David Coffey. The four leaders are going on the pilgrimage in solidarity with Christians living in the Holy Land, and they're calling on all the faithful to support them with prayers for those living in the land where Christ lived. They're due to arrive in the Holy Land on December the 20th, then travel to Jerusalem to meet local church leaders. The following day, they go to Bethlehem to visit the Grotto of the Nativity, where an ecumenical service will take place. The pilgrimage will be based on prayer and reflection on the scriptures and opportunities for shared worship with members of the local Christian communities. The four leaders are due to return to the United Kingdom on December the 23rd. At a recent press conference, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor explained how the idea of this Christmas pilgrimage came about.
There's something called Churches Together in England, which is a body of all the churches, and the four leaders of that are the Baptist and Orthodox, the Archbishop and myself. And we've decided jointly to make a pilgrimage just before Christmas to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem. It's a pastoral visit. And the purpose of it is really because of our concern for the Christians who live in the Holy Land. Many of them are discouraged by all the difficulties that they face, and many of them are leaving the Holy Land to go elsewhere. Now, we want Christians to live in peace and tranquility in the Holy Land, both as a sign of the presence of the Christian community there and also helping with the welcome to the numerous Christian pilgrimages that go to the Holy Land. So, as a gesture, as it were, both of solidarity, of pastoral concern, we want to make this visit together.
Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor is the Archbishop of Westminster and head of the Catholic Bishops' Conference in England and Wales. Here in the Vatican on Monday, experts working with gypsy communities throughout the world come together for a two-day meeting organised by the Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant Peoples. Participants will be discussing ways of implementing guidelines on an appropriate pastoral ministry for gypsy communities, published by that same council exactly a year ago.
It is the first church document destined to all gypsies in the world. Various speakers will read their reports, which will be followed by general debate and reflection in study groups.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is secretary of the Vatican's Council caring for migrants and itinerant peoples. He tells us more about where the largest gypsy communities are to be found and how the Church is trying to help them overcome the stigma and discrimination they often endure.
There are some 36 million gypsies all over the world, in Europe, in North and South America, and in some countries in Asia. 18 million are thought to be living in India, the country of origin of the Gypsy population. With regard to Europe, the official estimates of the Council of Europe vacillate between 9 and 12 million, with a marked concentration in Eastern Europe. The greatest number of Gypsies is Romania. The estimates vary from 1,800,000 to 2,500,000 or more. This is followed by Bulgaria and Spain, with about 800,000 Gypsies each. In the United States, there are nearly 1 million Gypsies. The Gypsy population is made up of various ethnic groups, for example, the Roma, Sinti, Manouche, Calais, Yenish, etc., etc., so that it is very difficult to say how many communities they are divided into. Very often, too, the expression Gypsy communities refers simply to small family clans.
But how exactly is the Catholic Church trying to minister to the needs of these communities, often housed in camps with few facilities and cramped living conditions?
The Church's presence among the Gypsies is assured by specific pastoral structures, especially with priests and men and women religious holding responsibility also at the national level. They carry out their apostolate in close collaboration with the promoter bishop, who is responsible for a particular country. They are helped by pastoral agents, for the most part laypersons. Their number varies from country to country. For example, there are 100 or so pastoral agents in France, whereas in Germany there are only four dioceses that have a priest engaged in this pastoral activity. In carrying out their services, the pastoral agents adapt to the Gypsies' particular needs and culture. There are also pastoral agents who actually live with the Gypsies on their campsites. They form the so-called bridge communities. The problems and difficulties that pastoral agents have to face are not few in number. They mostly come out when meeting the Gypsies because of the different culture, mentality, and convictions. The document Guidelines for the Pastoral Care of Gypsies goes into the matter at length. Anyone who works for, with, and among the Gypsies must take their particular identity and culture into account. It is, in fact, ignorance of their characteristics that lies at the basis of discriminatory and aggressive acts toward the Gypsy population. Another question the Church cannot be silent about is the violation of their fundamental rights to lodging, schooling for their children, and employment. In addition, pastoral agents find their job made more difficult by negative attitudes on the part of the Gypsies themselves, and also by the poor image given them by the media. I would ask all to read our document to know and understand Gypsy life and its values better, against the stereotyped ideas we have in general in our society about them.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant Peoples. Freedom from grinding, poverty, and hunger is a human right, not merely a question of compassion. That was the message of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louise Arbour, for the International Human Rights Day, marked each year on December the 10th. The complex causes of poverty, she said, range from exclusion and discrimination to a skewed international trade system. Yet despite awareness of these problems, our approach to poverty reduction is often tinged with appeals to charity or altruism. All countries, she stressed, independent of national wealth, can take immediate measures to fight poverty by ending discrimination against women and minorities and promoting good governance and respect for the rule of law. Global leaders, she said, have recognized that development, peace and security and human rights depend on each other. Yet in today's world, one in every seven people continues to live in chronic hunger. And even the most optimistic assessments show that most poor countries are unlikely to achieve any of the Millennium Development Goals drawn up by world leaders 6 years ago.
I think we have to start with one fact, that most of the African countries south of the Sahara will not meet any of the Millennium Development Goals.
Archbishop Silvano Tomasi is the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva.
I think that's a kind of red light of alarm that should make us reflect why in Africa and in other continents there is this reality of extreme poverty or simple poverty, because 1 billion people live with less than $1 a day and 2 billion people live with less than $2 a day. So there is a huge gap between rich and poor in the world still now, notwithstanding enormous efforts made in terms of direct aid for development, giving cash for development to some governments, and also some transfer of technology and know-how. So some of us are looking at this panorama around the world, and the data that are provided by the agencies of the United Nations, because some of the most interesting information is given to us by the UN Commission for Trade and Development, or by the World Bank that is somehow related to the United Nations. And on the basis of the very information provided by these agencies, we can see that there has been some kind of a failure in bringing out of poverty most of the world. Now, it's interesting that through the process of liberalization of trade and the globalization of the markets, in the last few years, some 300 million people, especially in China and India, have been moved out. They have graduated, so to say, out of poverty into a more acceptable lifestyle. But what is that compared to the huge numbers that are still in poverty? I think it's a positive achievement that probably points out the road we need to follow in order to help other people to get out of poverty.
Let's look at that road. What is it that has been achieved in these countries that isn't being achieved in Africa?
I'm not an economist, but from listening carefully to what the ambassadors from the developing countries are saying, to what they have to say, and reading the information that is provided by the different agencies of the UN system, and trying to really also reflect on my own experience in Africa and in some other countries, I think that we can kind of highlight certain priorities. One is that in the countries that are moving forward in the improvement of their economy, there is a core base of people well-educated, so that in today's world that is very much depending on knowledge-based economy, the requirement of education is very fundamental. So where there has been work for some years on educating people, taking them out of illiteracy, then this has created like enough of a base from where to take off, to have qualified workers, to have reliable people, to have persons that can handle simple technology and so forth. A second observation is that the family structure is also a very important element in the economy. For example, in Asia, for all the criticism that may be labeled against some of the countries for whatever political approach they adopt, the family structure is pretty much a solid, normal kind of functioning unit of society that creates dependence in the sense that people can depend on this kind of structure. And second, that it's a reliable point of reference in case of emergency, so that it's a joint venture in addressing economic achievement, so people can work very hard, long hours, and they are supported by the family structure. So that's another interesting angle. And then there has been an opening of the market. I think we have to consider and accept this fact as an important dimension of economic progress. China, for example, in the last 20 years, has decided to become part of the world network of trade. It opened its markets to investment from outside, with certain controls, to be sure, but it's an opening. And in this way, we have seen that all along the eastern coast of China, there has been an incredible progress. However, there is a caveat. There is a caution that needs to be introduced. In China, 300-400 million people enjoy a very good life. They are part of this boom of the market. But then we have probably another 600 million people who are in the backwaters of China that have still a lifestyle that is very much without some basic assistance in terms of health, education, and so forth. So we need to balance these things. But as part of the important ingredients for a movement forward to uplift people out of poverty, I think the opening of the liberalization of markets is very essential. On the other hand, you know, globalization and liberalization of markets is not enough in itself. I think we need some rules and some fairness so that the results of the increased wealth obtained through this kind of process, the result may be a more even spreading of the benefits. Otherwise, we have a Wild West kind of economy where you have an objective increase in wealth, but you don't have more people participating in this benefit and having their lifestyle improve.
The Church has long been concerned with promoting global solidarity alongside a globalization of the markets, urging wealthy nations to give more generous development aid and promote a fairer system of international trade. Yet despite debt relief and an increase in aid to the poorest nations, many of these countries are simply not seeing improved living conditions for the majority of their people. Archbishop Tomasi says it's vital to address problems of corruption and wastage in both donor and recipient countries.
Last year, the international community gave $50 billion for development, one way or the other. $20 billion went to consultants. So there is something that does not click right away. But I think there is a lot of goodwill in some countries to bring their contribution for development up to 0.7% as they had committed themselves some time ago. Not many countries have reached that goal, but there is a movement upward in terms of the percentages contributed. And this is a component that is necessary because some of the poor countries need cash and need this kind of assistance in order to move forward. To make this direct contribution, be it in cash or be it in technology or know-how forms, you need to have a counterpart. We must also look at the other side of the medal. Corruption is a choker of development, and it stifles possibilities of growth in many poor countries. And we need to talk more about it. We need to address this issue in a more forceful way. Also because some of the money that is lining the pockets of some leaders or some corrupt figures ends up in Europe, and it ends up in the banks that are quietly supporting a system without obviously explicitly planning to do this, but are supporting a system that is against development. So we need to work at the point of arrival of the help that is given.
Greater transparency.
Fighting corruption, greater transparency, facilitating private property. I know in some countries there is still a reluctance to give ownership of the land to the people or to make them at least secure enough in their piece of land that they are managing to stimulate creativity and to encourage them to produce more, to save, and to begin to generate an economic system that begins to function. So we need to balance things. And at the same time, we need to examine on the part of the rich countries all the pledges that have been made along the years to cancel debt, to contribute more in a more organized and a more coordinated way, assistance for development, to coordinate also in terms of the relationship between what international agencies are doing and individual states are doing. So there must be a convergence, so not that one ignores what the other is doing, or sometimes funding the same project or creating this type of confusion.
Money being wasted, in other words.
There is a need to create a tighter dialogue between the people and the donors so that the priorities are determined by the receiving people and the donors can control.
Thanks there to Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. We'll be back on the air, of course, at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. In the meantime, don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.